I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. An apocalypse, we've been learning, is neither bang nor whimper and never quite the end. It's a sort of darkness unveiled, as in the Bible's closing book of Revelation. In Aleppo today, in the fire and flood weather wars of August 2016, apocalyptic describes more than a state of mind.
The devastating effects of El Nino, the lack of rain accompanied by heat waves.
At least 11 people killed in the Dallas area this weekend. Hundreds of homes and buildings, look at that, just simply
destroyed. Turkey in chaos in the wake of a failed coup attempt.
Thousands stranded in Greece without access into Europe, and those frustrations are increasing.
I call it extreme vetting. These are problems like we've never had before.
This is the third in a conversational series about a way of thinking around a sorry state of affairs. Enrico Fermi's paradox got us started. The bomb scientist mused back in the 1940s that the reason we've never heard from advanced life on other planets is that abundant life out there gets leveraged out, as we are, on a shelf of high technology and then collapses in dust. Did Fermi mean us? The question is still current, and it's a part of the conversation this hour.
The most dangerous characteristic you can have is intelligence. If you have nothing but fairly dumb animals, everyone gets on just fine. Once evolution produces a smart species, pretty soon you're talking science fiction and trouble.
Today, the most aggressive high science is apocalyptic in its own way, notably the artificial intelligence that could eclipse human thinking and the surging genetic sciences that could improve our DNA and the human condition beyond recognition. This hour, from the research towers to the street, there is trouble on the ground that makes the high theory a little more urgent. Chaz Freeman works both levels, a legendary player in the rough and tumble of American empire for 50 years, and a critical thinker at the highest levels of military and political intelligence. We jump at the chance to engage him. He's in retirement now on the Rhode Island shore. 44 summers ago, Chaz Freeman was Richard Nixon's translator in the breakthrough opening with Mao Zedong in China in 1972. Then he was George H.W. Bush's ambassador to the Saudi kingdom during the first Gulf War in 1991. He spoke to me the other day with something like dismay, an elemental unease, he said, about what is coming, a vexing drift in politics and policy, a stench of fascism, he said, in the air. And then he got down to cases.
One would have to start with the situation in the United States politically, which internationally is seen either with dread or derision, or maybe both. The United States has been the global leader. We have defaulted on that role. And to the extent we exercise leadership, it seems to be more destructive than constructive. We look around the world, you see Europe falling apart, the British indulging in the insane idea of Brexit, European Union that is adrift, Turkey, a country that is central to so many issues, is obviously in a very serious state of decline and deterioration in its democracy. And also in its military power. You know, you can't get rid of one-third of your general officers without having an impact on the efficacy of your military forces. Turkey is central to so many issues, and it is no longer a reliable partner. So just looking to our east, our Near East, Europe, and Turkey, which is on its border, without even discussing Russia, things look pretty dark.
When I think of apocalypse, I think Syria. That is an apocalypse. Describe it as a man of your experience sees that horrible breakdown.
Well, it is a horror. You have probably something on the order of 450,000 dead Syrians since 2011 when the United States piled onto an effort to dislodge the Assad regime from Damascus. 11 million Syrians, half the population, displaced from their homes. An avalanche of refugees moving from Syria in the direction of Europe, threatening the stability of the European Union and burdening Turkey, and now becoming involved in sectarian strife in Turkey as well as in their own country. And nobody has an answer to this. Everybody seems to be prepared to fight to the last Syrian. And the United States has no answer other than adding weapons and explosives to an already terrible state of anarchy and civil strife. There's no strategy for ending this. So it is, in a sense, a symbol of the ineffectiveness of global leadership, regional leadership, problem-solving by great powers. In fact, the Russians have probably distinguished themselves there more in the manner they've handled it than we have, which is a depressing thought.
The blood-din tide is loosed, as Yates said. Is it apocalyptic?
I don't believe this is the end of the world, although I think we're working on it. If you look at some of the things that we are doing as a species to our climate, our planet, to each other, if you consider the very great likelihood of pandemics, given, you know, any animal population, and we are ultimately animals, although we want to pretend that we're above that, any animal population that becomes as numerous and as dense as ours has become is asking for culling by disease. And we keep seeing nature starting that process. So far, we've managed always to respond in sufficient time with sufficient effectiveness that we haven't seen the consequences that we saw, for example, in the Spanish influenza in 1917. But now we have Zika.
Can you just connect some of the dots here? Brexit, they said, was an immigration crisis. Immigration is a failed state and famine crisis, drought crisis in Africa, in the Middle East. What are the roots of this thing? And where did we miss the turn?
Well, if you speak of political unpredictability, strange decisions, election campaigns that go awry, which I think is a good description of the Brexit process and decision, or of what's happening in our own politics at the moment, you see a lot of points in common. Now, there's a general despair with the possibility that we can solve problems. There used to be, in connection with technology, a sort of Native American optimism that through science and technology, we could solve any problem that confronted us. Now we look at science and technology and imagine, to use your word, apocalypse. We see robots displacing us from our central place in our universe. We see the possibility that genetic engineering will disturb our natural state to such an extent that we threaten our own species. We have lost this optimism that we had. I am a reader of science fiction, and I enjoy it not for the dark visions of dystopia that now prevail, still less for the fantasy that's largely replaced reference to science. A lot of science fiction, so-called these days, is actually very anti-scientific. Almost all of it is pessimistic about the human condition. If you go back to the 50s, 60s, the sort of great age of science fiction in the United States, you will find that it was a literature of optimism, of human expansion, conquering new worlds, exploring new realities. Interestingly, I read Chinese, and Chinese science fiction expresses this optimism today.
Really?
Yes. There is a faith in China that technology and science can indeed overcome. I think they are charting their own trajectory as they see it. This is a country which has gone from abject poverty and international isolation to a fair degree of wealth, a huge middle class. You know, they're graduating 1 million engineers a year now in China. They're graduating 7 million people from university every year.
Not to mention 40 million pianists.
Yes, lots of talent being unleashed. And there's a kind of confidence that this will make a difference. I think the United States is currently graduating around 70,000 engineers a year. And this tells you something.
Come back to the roots, maybe in nature, maybe in human nature, maybe in climate change, to the vexing drift that you write about, political paralysis, ubiquitous malaise. What are the real roots of this thing?
Well, I think one of them, as I said, is a sense of despair that existing institutions can effectively address existing problems.
Where does that come from?
It comes from the inability of our political class to deal realistically with things. Look, we're operating in this country under a sequester. What that is a national decision not to make decisions about priorities. Budgets represent priorities. It is a national decision not to learn from other people abroad, not to follow or adopt best practices as seen elsewhere, not to adjust the pattern of what we have been doing to change it. And it is, therefore, a default on strategy, on leadership. I can't blame people for feeling dispirited, but there are other issues as well, as we all know. We have gone through a long period in which the middle class has been squeezed from both ends. The number of the poor deprived has gone up. The amount of wealth in the hands of the very top level, 1%, has increased astronomically. What we do now is financial engineering, not the real kind. And the size of the financial sector in our economy has grown to absolutely unseemly levels. I think it's now about 9% of GDP. This is essentially buck passing for a profit, and it is not productive. The sense that this country founded on equality of opportunity now presents few opportunities to those not born to wealth.
We'll have a bit more of Chaz Freeman on the climate, and then coming up, the legendary investor, Jeremy Grantham, on what the money class knows, doesn't know, and doesn't know it doesn't know about apocalypses. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It's not the end of the world, retired diplomat Chaz Freeman was just saying, but we seem to be working on it. He's connecting dots at his summer and now retirement place on the Rhode Island shore, where he wonders if the grandchildren will get his house or the rising tide of Narragansett Bay instead.
We're already seeing important fallout from climate change. You mentioned drought in the Sahel, in West Asia. This is in many ways, if not a source, at least a direct contributor to the refugee flows that now trouble Europe. It won't be too long before a fair amount of Bangladesh is underwater. That's 200 plus million people whose fate is most uncertain. This will touch us closer at home. How much of Florida is going to be above water when sea levels rise? What about the New York subway system, which is already flooded by storms like Sandy? We are seeing a shift in crop patterns, agriculture, bird life, invasive species, all produced by climate change. In the end, much of the American wheat belt may end up being inhospitable to wheat, and Canada may become a much more important part of North America than any Canadian now dreams of. So there are huge effects, not just these, but violent weather, which we confront on an increasing level. Superstorms, frequent tornadoes, violent winds, flooding. All of these are becoming much more common. I live in Rhode Island. I have a house that is surrounded on three sides by water. I have watched in my lifetime the water level rise about 10 inches, and I can see that at some point in the future, my children, who own my house, will not be able to find it.
Chaz Freeman, I like to think of you as the young Foreign Service officer out of college who busied himself to learn Chinese, and there you are suddenly at one of the, in retrospect, one of the most promising. We didn't know the promise of that moment when Kissinger, Zhou Enlai, Mao Zedong, Richard Nixon said, let's turn a page. Was it as heady a moment as it seems now? And where did we go wrong?
It was a very heady moment, personally, because I had anticipated our need to reach out to China and wanted to be there, and much to my astonishment, I was. Mm. I thought it was fairly obvious that a global geometry in which two main parties were in contention and a third had been briefly allied with one of them and was no longer allied with it, that the other one, us, would have to reach out to, in this case, China. So I wasn't surprised. I had read, by the way, Henry Kissinger's masterful history of the concert of Europe and the balance of power there. Mm-hmm. It's focused on Metternich, called A World Restored. And in it, one of the sub-themes was the need to pull the fangs of revolutionary powers by entangling them in the established order. And that is precisely what we attempted with China, and to a great extent succeeded. Where we have gone wrong with the Chinese in more recent days to recast the shifting balance of power in purely military terms. But that's become an American habit. We're very militaristic in our approach to international affairs. So Mr. Trump says, I know more about ISIL, the so-called caliphate, than the generals do. And Hillary Clinton says, no, he doesn't know more than the generals. Mm. But the fact is the generals know very little about ISIL to begin with, and what they do know has been proven wrong on the battlefield. We have not done terribly well against this phenomenon of Islamist terrorism with global reach. Ask the inhabitants of Brussels, Paris, about that.
Chen Shui-min, I have to say, there's a nostalgia out there for people like you in the government. I think a lot of us still assume that there's somebody very much like you with a long memory, with access to the ultimate intelligence and some confidence about the future, who's sitting there under the Situation Room, behind the Situation Room, planning this stuff. Who is in those rooms thinking around the kinds of questions you talk about?
There must be somebody. but if they are there, they are hiding very effectively. So really the question is not, are there people thinking about these specific issues? The question is there a leader who can synthesize, who can take all of the competing priorities and develop a strategy? And I have to say that has been missing. You know, we're talking in a way about why the citizenry, particularly in the West, seems dispirited. And the answer is that they see, we, the citizens, see our political rulers, our betters, our political elite as letting us down.
What Jeremy Grantham has in common with Chaz Freeman is a picture postcard water view, Boston Harbor in Grantham's case, and an eye for storms on the horizon. Jeremy Grantham is chief strategist of GMO, with more than $100 billion under management, one of the biggest investment funds in the world. Wind him up, and he loves to talk about what people do not learn in the investment business.
Income equality is the key to a society getting on well. It correlates with everything that matters in life. You live longer, you're healthier, you're less obese, your 16-year-olds don't have children, you don't shoot each other. There are fewer people in prison. Everything is correlated with income equality. So you have Japan and Sweden and Norway and Holland at one end, and you have the U.S. at the other. The U.S. is absolutely dead last, and it is the most unequal society in the developed world. It is, in fact, in rotten shape. The panacea is actually to make society steadily a little more equal and have it be seen to be doing that, and things would start to get better remarkably fast. That's what the data suggests. The statistics are really shockingly clear. The people who borne the brunt are, I think, conveniently described as the person with the median hourly wage. I mean, 40% of Americans earn less than $15 an hour. And yet, the GDP has not been doing badly. So the GDP looks pretty respectable, and the median wage looks horrific. I'll tell you the most frightening statistic for me. There have been 11 million jobs created in America since the low in 2009. How many net jobs have been created for people who have no college? 100,000. In other words, none.
We think of you, Jeremy Grantham, as first and foremost a long-term investor and student of markets. What does an investor, long-term investor, make of 2016 so far?
A long-term investor, one hopes, understands that the short-term has very little relationship to long-term fundamentals. Value works, but it only works over very long horizons. The things that really matter are existential. I think the one that's most underappreciated is the extra 2 billion people that the UN profoundly believes will crop up in the fairly near future by 2100 in Africa. All 2 billion of net increase in the global population will be in Africa. And as I see it from a comfortable distance, just thinking about long-term forces, Africa gives a pretty good impression of being a failing continent. There's hardly a country you could find in Africa that doesn't have some stress. And the weather is going to impact them the worst of any of us. Bad enough anywhere, terrible there. They can afford it the least. They have a huge drought as we sit, which is just adding to the pain. Their soils are really the worst of any continent. They're old, tired, exhausted soils, and they're degraded to the extreme. The water supplies are totally inadequate. The governance is terrible. What's good, you might say? In terms of the ability to feed an extra 2 billion people, I would say forget about it. So they're all going to want to emigrate. When I was born, there were 21 million Nigerians. So there are 189 now, and the UN promises that there will be over 800 million in 2100. Now, you simply cannot take the number of people who would like to come. And some of these will be genuine, failing state, seriously distressed refugees. Mm. And nevertheless, you will have to turn them away in Europe because you can't absorb billions of starving Africans. So it's going to be a point of incredible pressure. How does Africa handle it? How does Europe handle that? How destabilizing is it for Europe and therefore rippling outwards for the rest of the world? That's, in a way, existential. And lying beyond that is the erosion of soils. 1% of the global soil on which you can grow food is blown away and washed away every year.
1%?
1%. Oy. It is said that about a third of all the potential arable soil that we had 12,000 years ago, since agriculture began, has gone out of business. Apparently in Greece, you can find an ancient Greek temple of, 3,500 years old, which is 4 or 5 feet higher than the surrounding land. Mm. Everything below that has been slowly but steadily eroded.
Mm. What does the investor's head learn?
An investor has a license to ignore everything that's long-term. So the worst thing you can do, really, is ask an investor for any useful comments on these topics because he's not interested or she is not interested. Good investment is about sizing up opportunities in the next few years, few months if you're that good, and capitalizing on them. It's not about sizing up problems over 30 years or 50 years or 100 years. Society hasn't come to grips with the fact that growth in any physical terms cannot be sustained. You cannot have physical growth. You can have qualitative improvements God bless them, which will make people happy. But you can't have physical growth. You know, the people who say, oh, they've been saying that forever, are really like the people falling out of a very tall building, so far, so good, so far, so good. Of course, the so far, so good argument can always be used, but anybody with a slight math tendency can see that compound growth is unsustainable.
Remind us why.
Well, I have to give you my favorite quote, which is, the only people who think you can have compound growth on a finite planet are either madmen or economists. Anyway, we've got to get into people's skulls. And I have 100 different examples, as other people have, about the ludicrousness of compound growth, but I'll give you some. The Egyptian Empire lasted for 3,000 years. The same language, the same religion, the same pharaohs. They had a few rude interruptions for a while, but basically it was a remarkably sustained culture. What would happen if you tried to grow their physical possessions? In 2007, the global rate of growth was 4.5%, physical growth. And the year before was 4.5%, 2 years back to back. So let's do that for 3,000 years. And let's start with a modest 1 cubic meter of physical possessions in ancient Egypt. What did we have 3,000 years later? 4.5% compounded for 3,000 years, which you can do amazingly on an iPhone, is billions of solar systems. Billions of solar systems to give the Egyptians just 4.5% compounded wealth, starting with nothing, in physical possessions like TV sets and houses and cars. So how about 1%? Let's look at population. Let's grow their population at 1%. The world's population has been growing much faster than 1% in my life, much faster. So let's grow the ancient Egyptians by 1%. What happens? You take their starting population, which was very modest, maybe 3 million, and you multiply it by 9 trillion times. Now, at this point, if you're not mathematical, you're going to say, I don't believe it. Well, check it. How about 0.1, which is a growth rate which any economist would snivel at, and talk about the end of the world, would multiply the population of ancient Egypt by 20 times. It did nothing like 20 times. It may have doubled. So you cannot sustain 0.1 in population or physical possessions for long periods of time.
What's the practical moral of that?
Sooner or later, politicians who would run a mile rather than admit the obvious truth have to come to grips with it and have to accept the really critical problem that the whole society has to be nudged genteelly, sensibly, educated to the idea that we have to approach a zero-growth world where only qualitative changes matter. So you can have better cell phones. You can have smaller, better television sets. But you can't have compound growth in anything. You can't have compound growth in energy use or any physical production or people, above all. I'd like to say about capitalism, by the way, 99% of all of the issues are handled wonderfully by capitalism. It takes all these input, all these costs, all the demand factors, and somehow, almost magically, produces a decent balance of products that please people who need them. It only does two or three things really badly. It just happens that the two or three are the ones likely to bring us to our knees. The existential issues, long horizon issues. I define this whole thing as the race of our lives. On the one hand, we have enormous technology potential, great progress, unrealized really by environmentalists, amazing opportunities to see the world transform itself. And on the other, we have these problems that we've defined. I see technology as the cavalry trying to head us off from the cliff. We are fairly determinedly running towards the cliff edge, and maybe the cavalry will arrive in time. What are the odds? I think in the more immediate future, the next couple of hundred years, maybe 50-50. It's a very, very close race. And let me put it this way. This is how close it is. We've been around for 300,000 years. And yet, if you give me the technology of 100 years ago and the population of today, we're doomed. We do not have a prayer. If we had 7.2 billion people and the technology of 100 years ago, it's over. We'd have starvation and collapse of civilization within a few decades. But if you reverse that and you say, take today's technology and the population of 100 years ago, 1.4 billion people, then we are going to cruise effortlessly to a sustainable future. Now, that is a real horse race, isn't it? That everything comes down to a 100-year window out of 300,000 years.
Among the pearls of financial advice that Jeremy Grantham dropped along the way was a point that our next guest has put to practice. The best investment for the long term, Grantham said in passing, is organic improvement of every bit of forest and agricultural land you can get your hands on. Coming up, the novelist and environmental radical Paul Kingsnorth on his own 2.5-acre farm with his family in County Galway, Ireland. This is Open Source. Paul Kingsnorth was well known in England as an environmental alarmist and protester, also a poet and an all-round troublemaker. And then, approaching 40, he turned, not back exactly, but inward. 2 years ago, he had a hit with a curious novel titled The Wake. It's out in America this summer, and it's now a Mark Rylance property for the movies. The apocalypse in that story is 1066 and the invasion that brought Christian civilization to Anglo-Saxon England. On second thought, Kingsnorth decided, pagan old England before the Norman conquest felt like the real thing. It was Brexit thinking from a millennium before the Brexit vote. To hell with Europe. By now, Paul Kingsnorth is working a small farm and writing with his family all around him and dirt under his fingernails in rural Ireland.
What are you doing?
I'm just doing a bit of recording, so you stay over there, guys. Just over here.
The new novel from Paul Kingsnorth is called Beast. It's spoken by a man alone in the present day on a wild moor, coming to realize that on a planet teeming with life, bugs, birds, trees, the big human mistake was to set our species apart. Kingsnorth read us just a telltale bit of it.
I was a stranger here. I could see it now. I was a foreigner, an invader, an immigrant, and they were turning on me. The trees, the hedges, the beetles, the things that live in the soil, they were turning on me, hissing at me. They wanted me out. They wanted me gone. The anger inside me had shifted, and now it felt like a fear, like a great anxiety. I felt all alone in the world. I knew there was nothing for me here, nothing at all. A bottle of water, a walking stick, a pair of boots was all I had between me and the trees, the grass, the gods and the gravestones, and they all wanted me gone. They were coming for me. This was their world, and they would take it back. They would take it back from me. Soon there would be no lane here, no church, no paths. I could see the future, and in it was nothing but trees, nothing but the things living in the trees, and in the soil, a great silent green orchestra spread across the whole of the world. I had walked out too far. I had walked to this lonely place, and now I was surrounded, and they would eat me. So what you get from this paragraph is this sense of suddenly being an alien in the world, from somebody who had just been walking through the place, barely noticing it. So there's that kind of theme of the relationship between people and places and what happens when you pay attention to them. And also the question, which is, what if the place you are in has something it wants from you and it's not just the other way around?
A lot of people have written about an industrial sort of apocalypse. You go further. This is a civilizational apocalypse. Civilization is the enemy. And just what is it that's ending today?
Well, there's the big question. I mean, I wouldn't say civilization is the enemy as such. I would say civilization is something that we have done, which looks like it contains a lot of internal contradictions to me. There's a great concept that the author Ronald Wright came up with called the progress trap. And he takes us right back to, when we use the word civilization, we're talking about societies based on agriculture, which then develop cities and towns. The word civis comes from the Latin word for city. So it's an urban civilization, and it's centralized, and it's usually got a central government, and it's got the accumulation of wealth and power, and that becomes often a military state. And all of that is possible because of agriculture, which is something that you move out of when you stop being a hunter-gatherer. And the story that we're kind of told at school, or I was, is that we, as in humans, developed farming because it was a better means for providing for ourselves than hunting and gathering. So the hunter-gatherers are primitives who don't really know how to do anything, but then cleverly we develop tools, and then we know how to hunt, and then we learn how to farm, and we don't have to go and collect our food anymore, and it all gets better from there. The archaeology is rather interesting on that. On the cusp of moving from hunting-gathering to farming, human health collapses and human welfare collapses. So, for example, humans have never again been as tall as they were in the Paleolithic period before people started farming. They appear to be living longer. They appear to have been living longer then. They appear to have been healthier. All of this is likely to be because farming is very much harder work. There's a lot more diseases associated with close-quarter animal living. It's very much more hierarchical. The minute you're farming, often you have a lord over you. Somebody else claims the land. People go around putting fences up. And you get this kind of burst of activity which creates civilization. So you get these kind of cities, and within those cities you get great examples of human culture, and you get all the kind of things that we associate with civilization, good and bad, from art galleries to invading armies.
We've been hearing this on our program. Before we give up after re-engineering the planet, maybe the solar system, we'll re-engineer us genetically.
Oh, right. I'll look forward to that.
Good. I mean, how does it strike you as a remedy?
Well, it's interesting this, you know, because I always like to go back to basics and say, what actually is the point of any of this? What are we actually trying to achieve? I mean, I listened to some of these Silicon Valley guys telling us about how we're going to download our consciousness into silicon chips and live forever. But they can never explain why anyone would want to do that, what we're trying to achieve. There's just this sort of hallowed religious vision of something called progress. But we're never told what we're progressing towards, or what we might be losing in the process, or why this kind of thing might be good. So maybe we will be able to genetically engineer ourselves, but to what end? Just because we want to, just because we can. There's always this kind of discomfort at the heart of all these narratives that there's something wrong with being human. There's something wrong with being human. There's something wrong with being on the earth. There's something wrong with being an animal. We have to somehow fix that, like that's a problem. And I just think that's a deeply disturbing way of seeing the world. And I think that that kind of narrative ought to be challenged.
We had just that sort of conversation last week with one of the great pioneers of genetic engineering. And he was saying that, of course, we've got to get to Mars mainly to save human DNA from eternal loss if an asteroid hits us. That may require a new man, a new human genome. And that, in turn, is a reason to get busy with it right here and now on the planet. And there's a lot of power and money behind that drive.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. That kind of argument to me strikes me as a kind of psychotic human narcissism. Why have we got to save human DNA? We're one species amongst billions and billions and billions on a planet that we're rapidly destroying. It shows a complete lack of humility. And it's precisely the attitude that has allowed us to believe that we are lords of all we survey, and that we have the right to destroy anything that gets in our way, and that our survival is primary above anything else. If we are getting to the point where we are creating the sixth mass extinction in the planet's history, which it would appear that we are, we've managed to change the climate of the whole planet, we've knocked off half of the world's topsoil in about 150 years, we could go through this list for hours and hours and hours, that's our responsibility to fix. And if we've managed to do that to this planet, I don't think we deserve a holiday on another one before we've fixed the mess we've made on this. That's a kind of psychotic escape plan. What are we going to do? Just bounce around the universe destroying planet after planet? Which, incidentally, is the plot of the film Independence Day. It's just occurred to me. I don't know if you remember that. Psychotic aliens who just sort of are parasitic upon planets and then just jump to another one. That sounds frighteningly familiar, doesn't it?
So, Paul Kingsworth, I want to know what you're doing every day in Portumna, in County Galway, in the heart of Green Ireland. Not incidentally, it's one of those many places in Ireland that has a British-built workhouse for all the poor farmers that they'd just finished driving off the land in the 19th century.
Yes, There's a workhouse at one end of the town and there's a castle at the other.
Right.
The workhouse was run by the Earl who lived in the castle, so there's a nice bit of history. Some things have changed for the better.
Yeah, that's I was just sure. going to say, it's a reminder, it's a reminder that it's been a nasty, brutal, evil world out there for a long, long time. But
oh yeah,
what is Paul Kingsnorth and his family doing today?
Well, I don't live in the town. I live about maybe 5 miles outside it, and I have a few acres of land here. And
how many is a few?
We've got about 2.5 acres, which when I bought the land, I'd never had any land before. I've had an allotment and I've grown some vegetables, but I bought this land and I thought 2.5 acres, that doesn't sound like much. And it's actually an enormous amount of land, especially if you're trying to work it on your own with your family. I've got 2 children, my wife's here as well, and we kind of work the land together. We don't have any tractors or anything like that. So it's, it's quite a lot of work, but we're growing, we're trying to grow our own food and we're trying to be self-sufficient in fuel. We grow our own wood. I'm trying to rewild a lot of it with wildflowers. I'd like to keep bees. I'm really trying to leave the land in a good place and provide us for ourselves as locally as we can. We've been encouraged not to do anything for ourselves, but to buy everything we need instead. And that's a very disempowering thing. And it's actually very empowering to take some of those things back, to build your own toilet. That's a very empowering thing to do, I must say, for a slightly nerve-wracking one. I mean, we've got a repair job to do. And turning the whole question about apocalypse around, because we can kind of focus on the collapse, and the collapse is here, I think, and will accelerate. But one of the best things you can do, if it's possible, is to take a piece of land and nourish it and improve it and plant the trees and tend to them and, do some repair work. Humans have done so much damage. How much repair work can you do? Everybody can do some. You can have a tiny back garden, you can still do something. And that just seems like a useful way to look at things. You probably can't save the world if it even needs saving, but you can save something. You can do something. You can repair something. It seems like good work.
Paul, speak to the people who are listening to this program and want to know, what am I going to do? What is my family going to do? My children, my grandchildren, next week, next year?
Well, my feeling is that for the next generation or two or three or four, things are going to get very difficult. I think climate change is going to accelerate and economies are going to continue falling apart and things are getting harder all the time. We know that. Hmm. But I think that's a generational task, is to think about how to repair things, to think about taking some power back personally and as communities, to think about how we can live more simply and question these big stories. That's quite enough for most people to do for a lifetime, I would think.
Finally, Terry Tempest Williams. She's an author and activist out of Mormon, Utah. She's a witness to America's natural beauty in her latest book, The Hour of Land, about our national parks. But she's seen the catastrophic damage that we humans lay on the landscape, too. From the BP oil spill across the Gulf of Mexico in 2010 to a desert atomic test that she witnessed when she was 2 years old.
I grew up with the apocalypse. As a Mormon child, we were raised on the notion that there would be a second coming of Christ, that it would be preceded by wars and earthquakes and hurricanes and other man-made and natural disasters. But I didn't believe it. The world was too beautiful, and I felt instinctively as a child I had a responsibility to maintain that beauty, to pay attention.
You were also present at the creation, Terry, around that first doomsday cloud.
I had this reoccurring nightmare, this flash of light in the night in the desert after my mother had died from ovarian cancer. Every night, this flash of light in the night in the desert would wake me up, illuminating buttes and mesas. And a year after my mother's death, so this would have been 1988, my father and I were having dinner, and I told my father about this reoccurring nightmare, this flash of light in the desert. And he said, "Well, you saw it." And I said, "Saw what?" And he said, "I thought you knew that. It was a common occurrence in the desert." We were driving back to Utah from California. It was September 7th, 1957. Diane, your mother, was pregnant with Steve. It was an hour before dawn. We were heading toward Las Vegas, and this flash of light appeared. I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up. We pulled over, and rising from the desert was this golden-stemmed cloud, the mushroom, the atomic bomb.
My God.
This was a common occurrence in the 1950s and 60s.
Terry Williams, the more we think about the 20th century, the more it seems like a miracle that we survived it, and also that we're pushing our luck in this new century, in 2016. How do we face this?
You know, I think when we think of ourselves as a privileged species, a species with imagination and intelligence, rather than focus our imagination on fear and terror, I keep thinking, why don't we focus our imagination on how to take care of the Earth? I think the apocalypse is easy to believe in. We can see it wherever we choose to look. But to see the glory of heaven right here on Earth, the exquisite ecosystems that are still intact. And when we hear that the great biologist E.O. Wilson says we're going to need half the Earth in order to sustain life as we know it, in order to sustain us as a species, then that's where I want to put my imagination. That's where I want to put my direct action. That's where I want to put my muscle as both a writer, a citizen, and a human being. This is what we can promise the future, a legacy of care, that we will be good stewards and not take too much or give back too little. This is the privilege of imagination. We are not the only species that lives and breathes and loves on this planet. So we have the luxury of thinking about the apocalypse. Meanwhile, these beautiful species among us, whether it's a bison, whether it's an elephant, whether it's a chickadee, they are living the apocalypse of the world we've created, and we owe it to them to create a healing grace at this moment in time.
And still, Terry, people want to rely on technology to keep us away from the cliff. Does that impress you anymore?
Technology doesn't impress me, and I don't think it's the answer. I think these issues are not political issues. I don't think they're technological issues. I think they are moral and spiritual issues. And I can tell you, you know, having come from a clan of one-breasted women, where 9 women in my family have had mastectomies and 7 are dead as a result of nuclear testing, half my family is dead because of technology, of the sharpest, most hideous form, the nuclear bomb. I saw what happened in the BP oil spill. I saw pelicans dripping with oil. That is not a technological fix. That is a spiritual crisis.
Finally, for younger listeners especially, setting forth in this century, I repair to the vision of the great transcendentalists growing up in the neighborhood of Boston 2 centuries ago, and their insistence that the world is always new, as it was for Adam, and maybe no more or less troubled. Ralph Waldo Emerson, at the end of his first book, Nature, in 1836, put it this way. Adam called his house heaven and earth. Caesar called his house Rome. You perhaps call yours 100 acres of plowed land or a scholar's garret. Yet line for line and point for point, your dominion is as great as theirs. As fast as you conform your life to the pure idea in your mind, that will unfold its great proportions. Build, therefore, your own world. Onward, as Emerson used to sign his letters, ever onward. Thanks to Terry Tempest Williams, and also to Chaz Freeman, Jeremy Grantham, and Paul Kingsnorth. If you missed the first 2 episodes of this series, Apocalypse Now, with a question mark, visit our website at radioopensource.org and binge from the beginning. There you'll find videos, written interludes, and extra apocalyptic thinking from people like Kim Stanley Robinson, Lane Pagels, and other writers and historians. Thanks to Ethan Goldhammer for the use of his music during this series. This show and this series came out of a thundercloud in the mind of the brilliant Max Larkin. It was produced by him with Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, and Frank Horton. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath oversees the Situation Room at the end of our world. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.